One Saturday last December, a group of journalists were taking a tour of Guantanamo, the US prison camp in Cuba. Such tours are highly controlled. Access is strictly limited. Interaction with prisoners prohibited. Through one-way glass, they could observe some of the detainees, all of them captured as part of the United States' ongoing war on terror. One of them, a Yemeni man, somehow knew that the journalists were there. He went and got a picture he'd painted in an art class and held it up to the glass so the journalists could see it. On the paper was a giant question mark, and beneath its curve, not a dot, but a padlock. The prisoner artist, Khalid Qasim, has never been charged and may never be freed. When President Obama came to office 8 years ago, he also wanted to be free of the Guantanamo prison camp. But he leaves office this week with it still open. To understand why even the Commander-in-Chief couldn't shut down a facility which came to be seen by many as a stain on America's image, you have to go back to the beginning. I'm James Fletcher, and that's what we're doing on The Inquiry this week, as we ask, how did the US get stuck with Guantanamo?
Part 1. An island of ambiguity.
Ironically, for the first couple of centuries of Spanish control of Cuba, eastern Cuba and Guantanamo particularly is actually identified with freedom.
Casting his historian's eye over this dry, rocky, undesirable corner of the Spanish Empire is Paul Kramer from Vanderbilt University.
It was actually an area that slaves, pirates, people that were trying to escape the world of state colonialism would escape to because it was kind of under-colonized relative to other parts of the island.
The desire to shrug off the colonial yoke was not confined to Guantanamo. In 1895, a revolutionary war against Spanish control broke out across the island. A US warship was dispatched to Havana Harbor and then blew up under what were euphemistically called mysterious circumstances. The US joined the fight.
During the US operations against Spain, the US Navy gets a look at Guantanamo Bay in eastern Cuba. And in many respects, this is the perfect military outpost. It's got a wide harbor. It's very deep. You can anchor large-scale naval vessels of the kind the US is building.
The US Navy decided they wanted it for themselves. When the Spanish were defeated, they imposed military rule, and one condition for withdrawal was a treaty forcing Cuba to lease Guantanamo Bay to the United States.
It's what we could call kind of gunboat tenancy. The terms are very ambiguous. Basically, there is no end date for the lease. It establishes only that the U.S. will be in Guantanamo Bay, quote, for the time required. Even in terms of how far the base extends, it's fairly ambiguous.
...1959, revolution. Forces led by Fidel Castro took over the island, but the fiercely anti-imperialist Castro decided not to confront his gunboat tenant directly, fearing it would trigger a US invasion. Then the Cuban Missile Crisis brought the nuclear arms race to Guantanamo's door, and the base became cut off from the country that surrounds it.
So on the US side, you have the planting of the world's largest minefield by the mid-1960s. And on the Cuban side, you have the planting of these enormous cactus fields, which quickly get dubbed the Cactus Curtain.
In the 1990s, a new use was found. Guantanamo became a camp to house Haitian and Cuban refugees fleeing political turmoil.
Everybody's got a question, and basically it's the same one. They all want to know how much longer could they possibly be here?
You have 40,000 refugees that are being held on the military base in makeshift camps on abandoned military runways under really harsh conditions for long periods of time with their legal status very ambiguous. For these people, Guantanamo is like a legal black hole.
The issue came to a head when a group of Haitians had their asylum applications approved, but were then denied entry to the United States because they were HIV positive. Their lawyers argued that the rights and protections of US law should apply on the base. Judge Sterling Johnson agreed.
And what's quite striking and prophetic in Sterling Johnson's decision is that he says basically, look, if we don't extend U.S. law to these bases, we're creating a space in which the American military and the federal government can do whatever it wants, that we can engage in whatever cruelty, whatever violence we wanted against people, and they would have no recourse to American courts. And this is really dangerous in terms of American democracy.
But that victory was short-lived. In return for guaranteeing that the refugees could enter the United States, the US government managed to get Judge Johnson's decision vacated, stripped of legal force. 2 years later, another court case confirmed Guantanamo's status, under the control of the US military, but not subject to US law.
Part 2. Indefinite detention.
And there, as you can see, perhaps the second tower, the front tower, the top portion of which is collapsing. Good Lord. There are no words.
When 9/11 happened, the individuals throughout the administration wanted to find a place to bring detainees from the Afghan battlefield and, as it turned out, from elsewhere as well.
Meet our second expert witness, Karen Greenberg. She's director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School in the US. Since the attacks on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, she's written extensively about the policies and legality of the so-called War on Terror.
They wanted to create a law-free zone that was not just free from American law, but from international law as well. And once the name of Guantanamo came up at these meetings, the story goes, it was decided immediately.
Events moved fast. The Marines on the base were given just 96 hours to set up the new camp. And then, on January 11th, 2002, the first group of 20 prisoners arrived, blindfolded and dressed in orange jumpsuits.
They had no buildings to house them in, so they housed them inside these animal cages.
It wasn't just the prison that was built quickly. The base personnel were told,
we haven't quite figured out what the policy is here, and so you're just going to have to make it up as you go along. You can adhere to the spirit of the Geneva Conventions, but the Geneva Conventions do not apply.
The Geneva Conventions define the rules of war and the treatment of war prisoners, regulating their conditions and to what extent and how they can be interrogated. The US had followed them since 1882, but decided that these new detainees were what they called unlawful enemy combatants and thus not subject to the Geneva Conventions.
The justification was that the United States was surprised by this attack. It was considered a massive intelligence failure. And therefore, the remedy for it was we better step up our intelligence game. And getting information out of detainees was what they thought they needed to rely on.
These early decisions had two important consequences. The first was for how the intelligence was got out of those detainees.
There are innumerable ways in which the detainees were physically, psychologically abused. And I don't think we will know the full extent of what went on.
The second consequence, which resonates with Guantanamo's past and is crucial to its future, was for Guantanamo's legal status. Gone was the long-held idea that detainees should eventually be charged with a crime and tried. And in its place, a key new idea: indefinite detention without trial.
The argument is that These are individuals who are warriors, who belong under the kinds of considerations that you think about in war, and that to introduce the justice system is inaccurate, inappropriate, and dangerous. If we put them through the regular systems, then we were going to be victims once again of another 9/11.
The kind of people held at Guantanamo include terrorist trainers, bomb makers, extremist recruiters and financiers, bodyguards of Osama bin Laden, and would-be suicide bombers.
That's Donald Rumsfeld in 2005. But in reality, the US had swept up large numbers of people, more than 600 in Guantanamo's first year alone, and they didn't all fit this picture. Some were foot soldiers, innocent bystanders, petty criminals. By 2006, the public was becoming aware of this, as well as allegations of torture and ill-treatment at Guantanamo and other places like secret CIA interrogation centers.
George Bush faces the nation and he says, remember we told you we didn't have these black site interrogation CIA places? We do.
President Bush announced the closure of the CIA black sites, but they needed somewhere to transfer the prisoners to. Prisoners who included individuals accused of carrying out 9/11 and other attacks on the United States.
So I'm announcing today that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Abu Zubaydah, Ramzi bin al-Shib, and 11 other terrorists in CIA custody have been transferred to the United States Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay.
At that moment, Guantanamo goes from being not the place where the worst of the worst are to being a place where the worst of the worst in U.S. custody actually are. And of course, George Bush has said at times, oh, I wanted to close Guantanamo. Once the truly high-value detainees were at Guantanamo, closing it became much more of an uphill struggle.
The importance of that decision will become clearer in a minute. But back in 2006, momentum seemed to be turning against Guantanamo. The US Supreme Court ruled that the centre was not completely beyond the reach of US law or the Geneva Conventions, and in 2008 held that detainees had the right to challenge their detention in US courts. Political momentum had turned too. President Bush said he wanted the prison to close, and so did John McCain and Barack Obama as they campaigned to succeed him.
Part 3. No, we can't.
I think the mood was quite optimistic among the group of Guantanamo lawyers and advocates.
Our third expert witness is Jonathan Hafetz from Seton Hall University. He was part of the team that won the 2008 case establishing that detainees could appeal their detention, and was one of those Guantanamo lawyers buoyed by the election of President Obama that same year.
People were really hopeful that the prison would in fact be closed, and it's just amazing to see how that's changed over the course of the Obama administration.
Here's President Obama on his second day in office.
In order to close the detention facility at Guantanamo, consistent with the national security and the interests of justice, I hereby order.
But what seemed simple on paper was complicated in practice. There were 242 detainees left, and the government had to work out who could be released or transferred and what to do with those who couldn't. So President Obama set up a commission to study the matter.
Obama issued this kind of bold proclamation to close the prison, but then his next step was a kind of much more slow managerial plan of taking a year to study it and try to figure out what should be done or how it should be implemented. While Obama's task force was kind of studying the problem, the opposition to closing Guantanamo gained significantly in force, and the politics around Guantanamo became very toxic.
The first battle came when the Obama administration tried to transfer a group of prisoners to the United States. They were Uyghurs from northern China.
They were kind of the poster children for wrongful arbitrary detention. And they couldn't be sent back to China because they were persecuted there. But the plan got leaked. there was an outcry that was made over bringing so-called terrorists to the country, and Obama yielded. And as a result, the plan was dropped, and there was sort of a line that was drawn that no detainees could be brought to the United States, even if they were totally innocent, which made it much more difficult to close the prison.
President Obama suffered another setback when Congress blocked plans to bring detainees to the United States for trial. So why didn't he fight harder against this political opposition?
I think he was a little bit naive in terms of assessing or calibrating the depth of the resistance to closing Guantanamo. And I think also there was a piece of it, you know, he did not want to sacrifice other parts of his agenda. You know, he had other things he wanted to get done.
But it wasn't just political opposition that thwarted his desire to close the prison.
Even as he was promising to close the prison, at the same time, he was defending both in public and in court the legality of Guantanamo.
President Obama had come to accept the need to hold prisoners indefinitely without trial. And once he'd accepted that, the only way to end Guantanamo would be to move it somewhere else. But that proved impossible. And although President Obama did not send any new prisoners to Guantanamo, as he leaves office, it remains open despite his promise to close it.
I think the Bush years represented the creation of a prison outside the law, and the struggle was to reestablish the rule of law and legal principles, which did happen to some extent. The Obama administration was an institutionalization and a normalization of indefinite detention.
So how did the US get stuck with Guantanamo? Our third expert witness has explained how the Obama administration failed to overturn, in theory or practice, the existence of a prison beyond the law. So what does the future hold for Guantanamo and the men imprisoned there?
Part 4. Forever Prisoners.
So I'm at Guantanamo. 15 years ago today, the first 20 men arrived.
It's 15 years ago today.
Today. And I was sent down here by the Miami Herald, and we watched them come off the airplanes. And I'm still doing this job as we enter our 16th year.
Our final expert witness is the reporter Carol Rosenberg, talking to us from Guantanamo. Even when other journalists think a hearing is too minor to bother with, she takes the long, circuitous trip via Washington, D.C. to Guantanamo.
I'm in a press room in an old hangar that's been set up for up to 60 reporters to cover war crimes hearings, and I'm the only reporter here. I've been in and out of the prison for years. You know, the soldiers come and go. They do 9-month assignments. The attorneys come and go. Many of them are gone. And sometimes I feel like it's only me and the Al-Qaeda, the prisoners, who've been here from day one. When people close their eyes and imagine Guantanamo Bay, they see 20 men in orange jumpsuits on their knees in a cage at Camp X-Ray, an open-air kennel. But, you know, the prisoners, they don't live that way anymore. They're mostly held in two brick-and-mortar prison buildings, with a toilet, a thin mattress, and a wash basin. It looks like a typical American prison.
Although President Obama failed to close Guantanamo, he did reduce its size from 242 detainees when he took office to fewer than 50 now. Some of them are cleared for release.
It doesn't mean opening the cell doors and letting them walk out and get on a plane. It means handing them off to another country.
A further 10 men are charged with crimes.
So they're entitled to trials. And for the people who aren't in the death penalty trials, if they're convicted, there could be an end of their term and potential release.
Five of those on trial are accused of plotting 9/11, including the self-proclaimed mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
What they're doing right now is trying to figure out how to hold a trial that meets the standard of fair trials.
That leaves the men who haven't been charged with a crime nor cleared for release. Men for whom Carol has coined a name, the Forever Prisoners.
There are 26 Forever Prisoners that these boards have decided are, in their understandings, too dangerous to release, that they don't trust any rehabilitation program to take them. So they're war prisoners. And that means that they're held indefinitely without charges in this war on terror. It's been called the forever war because there's nobody on the other side to surrender. There's nobody on the other side to say this war is over, let our captives go.
And one reason some of these men may never be tried is that they were subject to torture at the infamous CIA black sites, rendering any admissions or information they supplied inadmissible in court.
Possibly the best known person would be a man named Abu Zubaydah, a Palestinian man who was captured early on in the war on terror. He was waterboarded. He was confined to a small box the size of a coffin. And while they've never found a crime to charge him with, because as he argues, he actually wasn't Al-Qaeda. He was a member of a rival jihadi group, and he had a different ideology. The U.S. considers him at this moment too dangerous to release.
We've heard how Guantanamo and the legal system that surrounds it began in the Bush era and survived the Obama era intact. What will happen under President Trump?
And we're going to load it up with some bad dudes, believe me. We're going to load it up.
I've seen the people he's assembling in his cabinet, and these are people who like Guantanamo. Its proponents really like the messages it sends. If you mess with us, you end up in a cage at Guantanamo Bay.
And what about the public? Do they care about Guantanamo anymore?
I will sit down on an airplane, and somebody will, you know, in a chat, they'll say, where are you going? And I'll tell them I'm going to Guantanamo. And they'll say, but didn't we close that? And so I don't think people are very sophisticated in their understanding of what goes on down there, despite my efforts to cover it for 15 years.
So how did the US get stuck with Guantanamo? We've heard how it was acquired through gunboat tenancy and how it became a legal black hole. This proved useful when 9/11 gave birth to an idea that the US faced such a grave threat that some people should be detained indefinitely without trial. At times, it seemed like the rule of law might be reasserted by the Supreme Court, by public or political pressure. But while conditions improved and torture was ended, the idea of indefinite detention seduced even constitutional law professor turned President Obama. And if you have forever prisoners, then you need a forever prison. Do you think it will ever close?
It's hard to imagine.
So will this be the story you cover for the rest of your life?
Oh, I sort of concluded a long time ago that I will retire in this assignment that I now see as an obligation.
This edition of The Inquiry was presented by me, James Fletcher, and produced by Estelle Doyle and Kate Lamble. Our editor is Richard Knight. You can rate or review us wherever you get your podcasts from, and we do love it when you do. You can also get in touch by posting a message on the World Service Facebook page or on Twitter. We're at BBC The Inquiry.